And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. You never know what you're going to want to write down. Okay, we're going to get right on into our commentary for this week. Our commentary for this week was written by Mark Herndon. Mark is an oil man from Oklahoma who has worked with as a volunteer with environmentalists for many, many years, it says here. He just spent a month trekking in the Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge. Please read what he has to say, which Uncle Dennis is going to do for you, and pass it on to your friends, which I am doing. Here it is from Mark Herndon. Hi, everyone. For those of you who don't know, I returned yesterday from a month alone in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in far northeastern Alaska. I'm really beat. I lost 25 pounds and basically feel like I've been beaten up. It was a really tough trip. I want to share a little bit about the place with you while it is still fresh in my mind. Things that I feel are very important. I want to grab you by the lapels and tell you a few things that are true because I have seen them. The Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge is probably the biggest chunk of absolute wilderness left in this country. I've also been in a part of the gates of the Arctic National Park and the Noatak National Preserve, two other large protected areas in the Brooks Range, but the ANWR is huge compared to those places. It's a place where you could walk your whole life and never see it all. Contrary to what you may have heard about the place in the media, it is not a vast wasteland. It is like heaven on earth and hasn't been touched by man. There's not a single building, not a single trail in an area that I've heard is about comparable to South Carolina in size. It's 19 million acres and there ain't no visitor center. Very few people go there. It is difficult and committing to get there. Since I have been there and with the current political situation about the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge coastal plain, I emphatically want to tell you what it is like and feel free to tell your friends. First, I paddled the Canning River, which is on the west side of the refuge. I started up high in the glaciated Brooks Range and hiked for a few days. Craggy mountains and a two-day snowstorm on the 4th of July. It looks wilder than the wildest parts of Colorado, but without any trees. That part of the refuge is far north of treeline. As I floated down the river, I saw gerfalcons, peregrines, and golden eagles. I saw muskox and had a long, close encounter with a grizzly bear. Everywhere there were tracks of caribou, muskox, grizzly wolf, and wolverine. I hiked up side valleys that were miles wide and absolutely flat tundra covered with lupins and Arctic poppies. A close examination of the tundra reveals hundreds of tiny flowers and lichens. Everywhere were old caribou antlers and skulls poking up through the tundra. Wolf-killed caribou skeletons also dot the tundra, often skulls with huge antlers attached. I saw more muskox and managed to walk pretty close to some of them before they got a little agitated. As I floated out of the mountains to the coastal plain, I began to see caribou in earnest, more than you could ever count. It was like being in a herd in Africa. This is also where I came out of the wilderness part of the refuge, and the river became the boundary between the state land on the left, where oil exploration goes on, and the Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge on the right bank. On the state land, I began to see many abandoned fuel drums and huge tracks on the tundra where cat trains shoot seismic in the winter. The tracks don't go away anytime soon. I saw abandoned drums on the tundra constantly after a while over on the state land. As I crossed the coastal plain, I saw many smaller caribou herds and began to see lots of birds, geese, ducks, tundra squans, and many strange types of birds. I have no idea what they were, probably migrating up from Hawaii or Chile to nest. All this time I saw more and more garbage on the left bank. Most of the animals were on the right bank. In this day and age, I would think that BP, Amoco, Exxon, and Phillips would go clean up all that crap. I made my way to the delta of the river where it empties into the Beaufort Sea, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, a lull in the wind, I paddled around about 10 miles across the 4-mile lagoon to an island that is about 6 miles long. There were many small icebergs about 30 feet across. I saw old sod huts that the Eskimos used to live on the island, and found the entire north side of the island was still fast against the sea ice that continues to somewhere near Russia, I guess. I walked out on it for a ways, and it is really rough. One day I watched ringed seals, which is the polar bear's staple food, sunning on the ice through binoculars. I saw a huge set of polar bear tracks around the lagoon side of the island, but they were pretty old. The island was just a few miles outside the Anwar boundary, and Exxon had drilled a dry hole on it in the past 2 years. It is one of the filthiest locations I have ever seen in my 15 years in working in the oil industry. This is a guy who's spent most of his life as an oil person. I was really surprised because the Exxon drill sites in the lower 48 are usually the cleanest of them all. I was not impressed with what I saw of the oil industry in Alaska. Then my bush plane landed on a sandspit and took me to the headwaters of the Jago River, which is supposed to be one of the most beautiful places on Earth. I spent 10 days in this valley, hiking up to the glaciated peaks at its headwaters. Part of the porcupine caribou herd had gone south up the valley a couple of days before my arrival, and there were millions of tracks all headed south. Interspersed were the occasional wolf or grizzly track. I saw a few stray cow caribou, but the show had already moved south for the winter. On the Jago, I was trapped for 2 days waiting for a rain-swollen river to come down so I could wade across. I fell in the same river on the way up, and wet gear up there is serious trouble because of the cold. The only way to describe this valley is to take the prettiest valley in Montana or Idaho and double it. It just took your breath away. It was so different that it may as well have been on the moon. One night I slept, a grizzly bear walked by my tent. There was a fresh set of tracks there that weren't there the night before. He paid me no mind. Anyway, I was picked up on a gravel bar on the lower river and flown out to Kaktivik on the coast. I heard that there were 9 white people in Kaktivik, but the Inupiat Eskimos who lived there were very nice people. You'd see someone cleaning a freshly killed bearded seal in front of their house. A local hunter, they basically all hunt or whale, heard that I'd been on the canning and sought me out for skinny on where the caribou still were. From there, I made all of the flights home. Before I went to see Anwar for myself, I already had some conceptions. After last year in Alaska, I thought that modern oil exploration could be done responsibly. Certainly most Alaskans were for it. They got $1,600 each last year from the North Slope oil money. But after seeing the Anwar, seeing that coastal plain for myself, I realized there were a lot of lies being told about this place. It is not a vast wasteland. It is achingly beautiful, and if you value wild places, the refuge could be considered a sanctuary or a cathedral. To me, it was an intense experience far beyond what I expected. I have been going to wild places most of my life, but I've never been to a place like this, not even close in the lower 48 states. There are a few places that are just not appropriate for large-scale oil exploration. This place is far more fantastic than Yellowstone or Grand Teton, but it is far and away, and few people care. If we put a bunch of drill pads on the coastal plain, we will be making a terrible mistake. Our country will never again be energy independent anyway. Those numbers don't lie. Drilling in Anwar will only help about 4 major oil companies in the state of Alaska, which is completely addicted to the oil tit. Those numbers don't lie either. It will only make a few percent difference to the nation. The first morning back, I read in the paper that the House approved drilling in Anwar. I felt like crying. That coastal plain is very narrow, and the most environmentally sensitive exploration would put a giant blot on it. Most of you will never meet anyone else in your life who has actually ever been to Anwar. Fewer still who have crossed the coastal plain. I emphatically urge you to listen to what I am saying and take it into account as you form your own opinions. The vote to open the Anwar still has to make it through the Senate, and those of you in Oklahoma are wasting paper by writing to your senators. To those of you in other states, maybe you can help. And remember, I am the oil industry. This was written by Mark Herndon. I am for drilling in many, many places, but not here. The price is way too high. I can't emphasize enough how special this place is. I don't believe the promise that they will only disturb 2,000 acres. When they get through shooting seismic in that place, it will look like a chessboard from the air. It's kind of like a football field. 22 players standing on their feet probably occupy far less than 100 square feet of that football field, but they sure do make an impression. The coastal plain is the living part of the refuge. The rest is very mountainous and almost sterile by comparison. To go stomping on the coastal plain with a series of industrial sites is just too much. I don't want to have to say that I saw Anwar way back before it all got messed up. And thanks for listening. For those of you who made it through all of this, it was written by Mark Herndon. And that's our commentary for today.
All right. For all you would-be space cadets out there, we got a little heads up of what you might be seeing out there while orbiting this great planet we've got. Here we go. An astronaut warns of environmental damage seen from space. an astronaut has warned of a dramatic increase in environmental damage to the Earth's landscape. Frank Culbertson says the destruction, which can be seen from space, is a cause for concern. The U.S. commander of International Space Station spotted the damage on his first space mission in 1990, but says it is much worse now. Mr. Culbertson said, "There's smoke and dust in wider areas than we saw before, and I've seen changes in what comes out of some of the rivers and in the land usage." He says astronauts can see massive areas across the world being burned to clear land-destroying forests. To find out more information, check out the internet. Grab your pen at www.anova.com. That's ANOVA.com.
And Into the Woods, Russian logging is out of control in this story written by Stefan Carter and Natalia Shulakhovskaya of the London Guardian. Fly across northern Russia, over the great expanse of Siberia and the Russian Far East, and what strikes you is the awe-inspiring sight of a great green forest stretching out below you for hour after hour without any sign of human presence. The great Russian forests are almost mythical. The deep, dark, and limitless woods are the setting of fairy tales, the home of the firebird, and one of the few really wild places left on Earth. But the forests are not just a cultural heritage, but a major resource facing new pressures that, if not yet a threat to their existence, are a serious cause for concern. Russia has about one-fifth of all the world's remaining forests. It extends to some 763 million hectares, an area about 100 times the size of Scotland. The total timber reserve is about 75 billion cubic meters, which would fill 35,000 astrodomes completely to the top. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the volume of timber cut has officially fallen from about 500 to 167 cubic meters per year. When the state logging companies were privatized, most of them folded. In absolute terms, Russian forests would therefore seem today to be under less pressure than they have been for decades. But this huge drop is just a part of the picture. The areas abandoned by the loggers were mainly those that were where exploitation was the most expensive. Production is now concentrated in places where transport is cheap and the wood is good quality. In the post-Soviet world, logging controls have been seriously undermined. Some environmentalists say the amount of timber being cut may be greatly underestimated, although they acknowledge that the problem is not the absolute volume of cutting, so much as where and how it is done. Theoretically, Russian forestry is highly regulated with a sophisticated system of permits, regulation, export controls, and rangers. Indeed, Russian environmental rules are some of the strongest in the world, with as much as the 47% of the country's forest off-limits to loggers. In practice, however, there are huge holes in that net. According to official figures, the scale of illegal cuts is significant. The total volume cut illegally last year is estimated at 732,000 cubic meters. Officials investigated 8,253 violations of forestry regulations last year, leading to 860 criminal trials. But they were just the tip of the iceberg. There are an estimated 30,000 violations of forestry regulations in total. Until recently, one body had the responsibility for managing and protecting Russian forests. Roshkohots, the Federal Forest Service, has a long and fine tradition of custodianship. It was founded by Peter the Great. Last year, it was incorporated into the Ministry of Natural Resources, an organization which, at least according to some environmental groups, is more interested in promoting exploitation than in protection. Now, where have we heard that before? The service is not just the protector of forests, but also Russia's single largest timber company, responsible for around 17% of the official national output. In the ramshackle town of Balagansk on the river Angara, deep in the Siberian oblast of Irkutsk, the forest is the lifeblood of the whole district. It is one of the few sources of work and the income of the town of 11,000. Everyone, every single person is getting into timber, says Valery Yamalavov, the deputy head of the district administration. Some cutting, he said, is done by individuals on own use permits given by the local administration. But the system is often abused by individuals selling their permits or through corruption of the local council. Roshlakosh officials decide how much and what wood can be taken, supervise cutting, and fine offenders. But there is widespread accusations against the people who work for Roshlakosh. Alexei Morozov, forest campaigner with Greenpeace Russia, says regulation is undermined by widespread and routine bribery, and the price paid for timber is artificially low. Roskohots employs thousands of low-paid workers, says Morozov, and there are obvious temptations when dealing with expensive wood. His concern is that commercial pressures are proving irresistible. Roskohots says firmly there are only a few isolated incidents of corruption. All that is done in the forest is marked on maps, written down, and submitted for checking. So to do it secretly is almost impossible, says Kumachev. Roskohots argued that it does not commercially exploit the forest. The timber it cuts is supposed to be from sanitary cutting, that is, removing individual dead or diseased trees, but it admits that these cuts are vital as a source of income. Kumachev acknowledges the problem. There is a certain paradox in that sometimes it is very profitable. Let me read that again. Sometimes it is very profitable. But only in a few exceptional circumstances, he says, does the Russian Forestry Service cut trees for commercial purposes. But the concerns are not limited to Greenpeace. According to Tatiana Goretskaya, section head of the Irkutsk Forestry Department, our sanitary cutting has increased sevenfold since 1993. In 1998 alone, forestry officials cut down 1.5 million cubic meters of timber under the pretense of doing necessary cleaning cuts. Then there is straightforward poaching. It is particularly bad in areas close to the export markets, like the Far East, where Chinese traders fuel a rising trade in raw logs. This is perhaps the most likely place for logging to do serious harm, as China exports an environmental crisis following the ban on its own cutting. In the Karmaskaroff region of the Pacific coast, according to Greenpeace, the problem has become so bad that a greater part of the population, companies, and state agencies of the region are now involved in illegal logging and trade in wood. It is not hard to see the poachers at work. In Irkutsk, the timber goes directly by train to China. At one rail spur, four workers were watched loading 600 cubic meters of timber onto two railway cars. Nearby, two smartly dressed men were doing the paperwork. But as the forestry police approached, they all ran. A search of some nearby shacks revealed 10,000 rubles, $200, in 100-ruble bills hidden in a heater. In a desk was a stack of letterhead with Chinese stamps and a timber price list. Vitalia Salamaka of the underfunded forestry police department said this one find of illegal timber would make very little difference. There are about 2,600 small companies all logging or trading in timber. It is impossible to control them all. We wanted to introduce licensing on timber trading and export because we were a region of the Russian Federation. We can't. It is, he suggests, a losing battle. Partly because of the poaching, it is hard to say accurately how much timber is being cut in Russia. But even if the official figures hugely underestimate reality, the volume is probably not the biggest threat. According to Vladimir Sakharov, vice president of the Irkutsk Timber Union, a trade and lumbering group in Irkutsk, the Siberian city where much of the timber trade is based, logging practices have deteriorated drastically. Now the region harvests only 8 million cubic meters a year, but when we cut down 20 million cubic meters in Soviet times, we used every bit from the stump to the needles. Now everything but the best logs are left behind. Moreover, the best logs are found in the untouched old-growth forests of particular biological significance. Russia, home to 26% of the world's remaining old forest, has already lost 70% of its original old-growth cover. Most of the companies work as if tomorrow will be the end of the world, said Mazarov. Economically available forests are under strong pressure, say Greenpeace, who report substantial overlogging close to export markets. There's no timber as far as 80 or 150 kilometers around Irkutsk, says Sakharov. It is mayhem. In Malagansk, Alexei Guritsko, a truck driver with the Lumberjack, says, you can land a Boeing in the Tyaga these days. If it continues at the same rate in about 5 years, there will be no forest left around here at all. For now, the decline in overall cutting might be said to compensate for the chaos and illegal timber extraction, but when Russia recovers economically, the problems could be more serious. Russian forests absorb something like 600 million tons of carbon dioxide a year. If they go the way of Europe forests, it would be a disaster not just for Russia, but for the world.
All right, just down the block, the Samarga watershed in the Russian Far East is also threatened. The Samarga watershed is located in the northeastern corner of the Primorsky region in the Russian Far East. This pristine, roadless, 2-million-acre watershed contains some of the largest areas of unprotected wilderness in Russia's biodiverse Sykhot Alin Mountains. As we were hearing about, the Samarga is an important refuge for wild Pacific salmon populations and is one of the last strongholds for the rare Japanese cherry salmon. Yum! The Samarga provides habitat to species including the Amur Siberian tiger, oh yeah, and the Himalayan black bear, big boy. The forests of the Samarga are also the traditional hunting and fishing grounds of the Yudegi people, about 200 of whom live in the remote village of Agzu, halfway up the Samarga watershed. For years, the Udugi have fought to protect their forests as an officially recognized territory of traditional natural resource use, which would guarantee their right to have a voice in natural resource use, of course. The Udugi worked with the environmental groups to develop sustainable economic development plans that were based on fishing, hunting, ecotourism, and use of non-timber forest products, and that would protect forests from logging. While the Yudigi were able to guarantee their forest products, and that would protect their forests from logging. While the Yudigi were able to guarantee their rights to wildlife resources, the regional government interested in the Samarga's timber resources blocked efforts to designate the Samarga as a territory of traditional natural use. Now the situation has taken a turn for the worse. Earlier this year, the Primorsky Regional Government auctioned logging rights to more than 1 million acres of the Samargan watershed to the Russian timber company, here's a mouthful, Ternelius, without informing or receiving consent of the local community. The auction was complete without any environmental review, even though this is a major violation of Russian law. For more information, check out, grab your pen, everybody, for this email address. It's info@pacificenvironment.org. And I think you guys know how to spell Pacific Environment. Us here in Santa Cruz, we rock it here on the Bay.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news tonight, Jason. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. cruzef@cruzio.com. If you want to send us letters, you can address them to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. If you want to listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer, you can do so every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's microradio.net/FRSC. There are lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime, so listen and whenever you want to. And you can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, dot all, all.net. Excuse me, radioforall.net. And search for the Earth First Radio programs. This is show number 157. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. And I want to thank Jason for helping out with the news tonight.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, Dennis.
Our theme music was written and performed by Gerald Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you again for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to David Rovix. This is off of his CD, Live at Club Passim. This is the Biotic Baking Brigade song.
See the man in his limousine, in his tie and well-pressed shirt, hoping that he's not been seen on the lookout for dessert. He knows What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the baking brigade delivers.
There's the chorus.
If you sell your city's soul to the landlord's greedy pack, you, my friend, have earned yourself a tasty pastry snack. You can call yourself a liberal and hope your crimes will fade, but your sellout soul will be exposed by the biotic baking brigade. What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the baking brigade delivers. If you cut down the last of the forests, spew poison in the air, don't you be surprised to find that cheesecake in your hair. Yes, if you are a corporate criminal, you've surely made the grave to receive a fresh baked goodie from the biotic baking brigade.
Here we go.
What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the baking brigade delivers. Industry, we know of your disgrace. So smile for the camera with the cream pie in your face. You can hope that we won't find you out as you're hiding in the shade. Someday soon you'll meet your doom, the biotic baking brigade.
Here we go.
What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the baking brigade delivers.
One more time.
What's that sailing through the air in the boardroom? See them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie.